Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Tracy Themes, welcome.
Thank you.
Right now, when we take a look at the baby boom generation, which are people over 50, maybe even a little bit more than 50, 55 mm-hmm. and beyond, the stats around marriage are that only one in three are married. Are there reasons why this is a good option, or is it something that maybe we're a little bit misguided about? In other words, should we bother getting married after we're 50?
So I guess I could see when I'm working with people professionally, and then of course being in that category, being over 50 myself, and looking personally, I guess we'd have to say that people over time may just find that the confusing elements of trying to put together two lives that have gone on for half a century mm-hmm. or more, because we become more exaggerated versions of ourselves, our problems, our suitcases of net worth, cash flow issues, personal development issues, sexuality issues, family issues, and it just could be that those
children,
suitcases
parents,
get to
grandparents, the whole works.
They gets too heavy to move forward. I think there's an increase in people that are actually opting to not have officially marrying. What I'm seeing is people officially living together.
Well, and I think that that's true, that there are people who are partnering up, but they're saying, what's the point of getting married?
You know, what I would hope is that as people age, they become more thoughtful. That's mm-hmm. my fervent hope, anyways, that we actually do accrue some wisdom. So what I would hope is that any decision that somebody makes over 50 is going to be made with those suitcases of knowledge and wisdom informing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's really only five reasons that a person would get married. One would be social, which is that the institution itself holds some value to them. Mm-hmm. They just simply like that everybody understands what being married is. There's no funny words. You don't have to figure out whether you use the word partner. Exactly.
Yeah,
everybody,
okay.
I mean, why don't we just come up with a stupid word and see if that solves a lot of the marital problems? Then there's the spiritual religious element, which is that people have very strong either religious beliefs that marriage is supposed to be doing something or not doing something, that there's certain privileges you have or don't have when you're married. And so for those, and then there's a spiritual reason, which is that they believe that there's a God who is necessary to form a covenant or to sanction that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be legal reasons. If you just live together, you basically are opting out of a decision to be in a formal relationship. You're waiting for the law to click in at the 2-year mark because
and
you're not spousal until 2 years. So what if before 2 years? So you're basically, the legal piece is that you basically had a piece of this taken away. And I've heard people say, I'm not going to have somebody else tell me when I'm a spouse or when I'm not a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to formally make that decision. Then there's financial reasons, which is that the institution of marriage with the immediate legal consequences puts into paper in sharp relief what your financial responsibilities are. Whereas if you're in a spousal relationship or non-spousal living or non-living, you're negotiating that from scratch all the time.
That I would think would be one of the huge impediments to getting married after 50, because by the time that the two partners are post 50, they have their own assets, they have their families, they have their responsibilities, and now you're saying, okay, let's blend that together, but recognizing that there's entanglements that come with that, because I bring my history, you bring your history.
Well, it's like we were saying, there's now we're all getting exaggerated forms of ourselves. So if you've been a mess about money, you're bringing your most exaggerated qualities into that relationship. So you're bringing in $60,000 in debt. If it turns out that you have mastered the art of your own cash flow and developing a high net worth, then you're coming in with $60 million, if you're really lucky. So you're right. That's one of the things that I think is so fascinating, is that I've never helped people get into these relationships and manage the financial piece where there's been a similar net worth. And that's where you get into interesting things too.
Right.
This is my little ballyhoo, which is that money's power.
Yes.
So it's not just finances that you're negotiating at 50. You're negotiating the power that comes with a discrepant net worth. And mm-hmm. that's where things start to get kind of interesting.
So, it's also interesting if you take a look at when you're in your 20s, and if we look at the traditional relationships that have existed until now, and it's changing mm-hmm. as we're getting much better gender equality as far as access to employment and salaries mm-hmm. for women. You know, there's a balance that's coming with younger generations. Still mm-hmm. not there completely.
Right.
But, yeah. so you go, okay, the man has more money early on in relationships traditionally and even still. But by the time that you get to 50, there are an awful lot of women who have been very successful. They have quite a bit of money. And how they got to that point, it's a different journey for everybody. But things start to change. And they're now going into relationships having to look after their own assets, and maybe they haven't looked at relationships from that perspective in the past.
Now, I see it the opposite, actually. So if we're going to go with sort of gender stereotyping, if you get two people in their 20s, whether it's a same sex or different gender relationship, it's the same. You haven't had time to have the exaggerations. Between 20 and 30, mm-hmm. you know, you've just either graduated high school or out of university.
Right.
Somebody's got some debt. You're at the beginning of your career. Your chances of having a very similar net worth, for instance, is very high. Then it's actually the migration of women out of the workforce. That the average mother in Canada is out of the workforce 12.5 years. So it's uh-huh. that migration out of the workforce and that middle life period that actually starts to exaggerate these discrepancies, not before.
Okay.
So that's where things, so you hit 50 and she's been out of the workforce 15 years, her marriage, or she's widowed or whatever. Now, you know, it's okay if she's raised your children, maybe. Maybe that's the unspoken belief that now she's everybody's in the money now. We've been 50-50 here mm-hmm. because this job got done and this job got done. But what everybody's doing is inheriting somebody else's background,
yeah.
right? So now we have no real social obligation, maybe not even a moral or ethical obligation to look after somebody else's family, but we have this discrepant earning potential mm-hmm. and potentially discrepant net worth. So that's more what I'm seeing, is that the women are more disadvantaged at 50 because they've now had this mm-hmm. being out of the workforce, for instance.
Got to get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break.
Certainly.
We'll be right back.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
Okay, so they come into a relationship,
yes.
a new relationship.
Yes.
One of the things that I was reading, interestingly enough, is that a lot of women over 50 are starting to get their heads around the idea that, I'm going to get into a relationship with a friend, in essence, that it doesn't have to be love first, that there's a whole bunch of other considerations that go into, okay, here's why I want to have a partnership.
And I've been reading, conversely,
yes.
that people in their 20s are doing the same thing. That they're actually living together because, for instance, in a place like Vancouver, it's extremely expensive to live alone.
Mm-hmm.
So you're spending every night at your girlfriend's or your boyfriend's, and you're finally going, why should I be paying $1,200 a month and you paying $1,200? I must have heard that 15 times after I got done speaking at UBC mm-hmm. from people. It's just like, let's just split the rent. Not understanding that you don't just live with somebody and split the rent. You know,
you're doing something else.
You are doing something else. So it seems like a good idea at the time. And then all of a sudden at 2 years, now you have again. The law doesn't say that this, just because you're 25 and stupid, means that this law doesn't apply to you or
right.
that you didn't think this through. You now all of a sudden have financial obligations and you have a legal contract.
Mm-hmm.
Although the problem with the law taking over at 2 years, the issue with this is that it can just, the people haven't consciously necessarily made their own decision about it.
Right.
So many people don't even know the law exists, is that you are actually spousal at 2 years. They've just been living together. They didn't know that and it's when they go to break up that somebody gets involved and says, well, you know, she gets half of your assets, or he gets half of your assets, or he gets this, or he's entitled to this, and then everybody's all shocked. So they've been living together for 16 years and they never really thought about it much.
So let's have that conversation that people have to have when they are going into a second relationship or a later age relationship, mm-hmm. and money starts to become an issue. How do you have those conversations? How do you say, you know, this is mine, that's yours, and not get in the way of a relationship? Because that seems to be the fear for a lot of people.
Everybody's making massive amounts of assumptions. And I think if we are going to maybe have some type of constructive intervention around marriage or whatever relationships you're going to do, is to start exposing the conversations. So I think that's like, it's a no-brainer. What I think is interesting is why we don't have them.
Okay, let's talk about that. And then let's talk about how you have that conversation.
You know, I've been asking everyone that I can see about this, mm-hmm. because I told you I was back from a high school reunion, and one of my friends is a brilliant educator, and so she's always bringing new information to the table, and she had taken a seminar on real truth, mm-hmm. and why in supervisory situations at work, people don't actually tell their employees the real truth. Like, you're not getting promoted because you smell. No, we mm-hmm. say, well, you know, your time will come, or, you know, if you hang around long enough, something will, we won't say the real truth. And so we're hanging around with that question, and I'm still interested in it. And that is all about emotion. Mm-hmm. Real truths, we're scared to get in these conversations because we're going to expose pieces of ourself, and it's going to lead to any number of emotional consequences.
But then we also have to deal with the reaction. I don't want to deal with the reaction.
Yes. Yes.
And so,
yes.
I can tell you the real truth about something.
Yes.
But then you have the freedom.
Yes. To have a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
And maybe I don't want that.
So what is it about the response that we don't want? What does it do for us or not do for us? What do you think?
Well, I think in a relationship, I go, well, if I'm that brutally honest, then you might leave me.
Okay. So abandonment is one.
And that's the fear.
Abandonment and rejection.
Or it's going to severely hurt our relationship.
So it would make it worse.
Yeah.
Okay. There's maybe also ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
What if somebody finds it ridiculous?
This is our second break.
Okay.
We'll be back in a moment.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
So, the further we get into a relationship, the easier it gets to start to have that kind of reveal that truth.
Opposite.
Because you think so?
You got to do it right at the beginning.
That's
the easiest piece.
You have to do it at the beginning, but I think that people are afraid that it will undermine the chance that the relationship will move forward. Now, I think, okay, it's mm-hmm. better to have it now and that it ends.
I know, and I do get it, because I send people out to get their potential partner's net worth all the time. And I might as well be asking them to go and shoot them. That's how their face looks. And so I have to get into this. What is it about revealing, asking for that, and potentially revealing your own that is so upsetting here? And you're right. They think it could be potentially the end. It also reveals our vulnerabilities. Because when we show what our financial situation, or any situation, that I have a kid with a special need, or that I've actually been a really crappy parent, my children are rotten, rotten people, whatever it happens to be, there's the rejection, but then there's the vulnerability it engenders in us. Mm-hmm. But then I keep wanting to go, okay, and then what?
Yeah.
And then what happens? Okay, so I've exposed this. I've already dealt with the idea that this relationship could end. What's the upside? And I think that's the piece that we haven't really been trained to look for. Which is, what happens if everybody actually just right at the beginning tells the truth as best as they possibly can? As best as they can.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what would happen? I mean, wouldn't there be some elasticity then? Even if you don't agree, at least you've created structures where people can be broader, bigger, deeper versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have 60 million and I'm 60,000 in debt, and we absorb that into that relationship.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if we absorb it, wouldn't that potentially mean that we had a minus $60,000 to $60 million range?
Mm-hmm. So you coach people on this
yes.
a lot. How do you start that conversation in a way that says, we're opening up this relationship rather than putting up walls or barriers.
Well, I let them use me to triangulate with. So they get.
So it's good to have an outside voice.
It's the best. It's the best. If it's something that's super touchy, and it isn't always money, there's a lot of things around what people want to, like when they're negotiating, one of the things that I say before we even get into the money, are you prepared to go back in and ask, what are our promises to each other? And then clarity around that, and what exactly is the objective of us doing this? Why have we done this? Which is how you opened this conversation. Now that seems, because there's a bit more dignity in the broader perspective. And I think that word about promises, and we've talked about this, promises is a great word. Because mm-hmm. I think it appeals to us. Maybe it's a Canadian thing, maybe it's just because the word has dignity to it.
It talks about fairness
and honor. Mm-hmm. I think if you were to ask me, my life belief would be most people want to be honorable. They rarely
right.
do want to. We just need to create ways that honor can shine through.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was coached myself that even in dating, that by the third date, you should be saying, what promises are we making to each other? At the point that you're starting.
By third date.
Third date.
Yep.
Yep.
What's this all about?
And not, I want to talk. It's just like, what are the promises that we're making here? And people say, well, I promise that I won't break up with you by text. I promise that I'll be on time. I'll promise that I'll pick up the tab half the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are little practice promises, practice ones.
Yeah.
So, and I keep saying.
I promise that I won't cancel the date at the last second.
So I'm trying to coach my young women to practice when the stakes are small mm-hmm. and to identify so that they will know when the stakes are small and when the stakes are big. So a few minutes ago, I actually challenged you on when is the best time to do this. Well, the best time is to do it. It's like a toddler, if you watch them falling on the ground, they're only falling a little ways.
Mm-hmm.
So they fall all the time.
Right.
And you just watch their little padding. I was watching some little kids play soccer the other day. But if you wait until you're 80 to kick your first soccer ball and you take it at a run, if you miss that ball, you're hitting the ground from a high position and you're hitting it in a compromised way. So I think it's at the beginning where the stakes are small that you begin having those conversations.
At the beginning, though, are those promises real? Or are they, I'm going to promise this because I think that it will make you like me more, and therefore it increases the chances that this relationship might take hold?
Well, I think it's great if somebody makes a promise that they think will make somebody else like them more, if they keep it.
Yeah.
So if they keep it and the other person likes them more, aren't we already down the path of honor?
So even if they were promising and it wasn't maybe their natural intent, but if they keep it, okay, then you win.
I had a theater arts teacher say, develop the externals and the internal will follow. If you behave honorably for your whole life, you will become an honorable person. I don't care if your heart wasn't in it, you're honorable.
Because your actions
right.
are what
speak. It's just like if you pound, they teach you in theater arts, pound the table enough, you'll start to get mad. So act as if. Act as if you have courage. Act as if this relationship, you want it to be a certain way. Act in the way that you want it to unfold.
Sorry to do this, but one last break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
So to make marriage work, to make it work financially, to make it work as far as the bringing together of your past lives, you're really coming down to saying you have to talk to one another and you have to talk to one another honestly.
You have to have conversations that matter.
Yes, you do.
There we go. I've got a little advertisement for you. So yes, I think that's what it comes down to. I think it comes down to exposing what your truths are.
But recognizing that it's not always easy.
It's not going to be easy, and you could have some losses along the way.
Because sometimes those conversations lead to, this isn't going to work
it's
for
not.
Us.
It's not. That's right. That's correct. It's like every negotiation you potentially can lose. And that's what people don't want to absorb. But every negotiation, you can also potentially get everything you want.
How do you know whether or not you've had the appropriate number of conversations to say, I'm going to make that commitment?
Even if you can't agree, if what you've come up with is a structure of truth telling. So You're at 60 million. I'm at minus 60,000. This was a terrible conversation.
I think in our case, it's the other way around. But
this was a terrible conversation. We had no idea that we were that far apart. You know, we play baseball together, and you know, bats and balls cost the same for you as me, and you know, we walk in the same neighborhood. We had no idea. So at first, we're absorbing. And so the first thing is the absorbing that there is a great discrepancy here. So I think if you can get to that first absorption stage and you get, and nobody really fell over, you haven't agreed on anything, but you're still staying in the process. Even if at the end we're like, we can't mitigate that difference, we can only work within it, then what we do is we're creating a structure, which is that, okay, we're gonna do the fair system in our situation is that I'll pay, you pay 1/10 of everything and I'll pay 9/10 because we have a discrepant income. I see people do that kind of thing, that and it can be on income or it can be net worth, that we're gonna do this in the proportion of meaning, in the proportion of power. That's how we're gonna equalize it. That's quite an interesting, and that's done a fair amount of the time. Another way is that your 60 million gets segregated legally and there's a pool that goes into the relationship pool. And it's just like, I'm gonna take 3 million of this and I'm gonna put it towards a house or I'm gonna put it towards a joint. That becomes ours. That's our pool. It's a gift into the, like there's a lot of creative things that people can come up with.
That's where having an outside party who isn't emotionally attached to it makes a big difference.
And somebody that's saying, I'm not hearing that you're actually asking or answering the same question. That's one thing that comes up. But yeah, you start to get into this dialogue. And then I get to ask the real hard things. How did you inherit that money or did you make that money? And what does it mean to you? Well, it means power. It means I always want the power. Okay, well then that's good. How do you feel about somebody having that much more power than you? And maybe they say, well, money doesn't mean power to me. So if they think that makes them powerful, that's fine. To me, what's powerful is love. And I have more love than him by a long shot. So, and he goes, well, you do. And I really value that about you. Well, you do this and I value. And then all of a sudden we're back in it, or it's different.
Then you have a relationship.
But what I see mostly is a lack of disclosure, and that's where having a third party is helpful. That's the piece that I see most often.
And then if you work all that out and you decide to get married, that's just the beginning.
Just the beginning. But you've got practice.
Yeah.
And you probably have an arc, like we call it, you have a conversational arc that you've set up where nobody gets, hopefully, you know, sideswiped or hurt.
Yeah.
And if you can have those conversations, because money's just an energy, the love is an energy, all of those things are, you've already created structures for having those dialogues that is hopefully productive and constructive.
So from your perspective, you believe that there's great value in getting married at any age. And
if everybody knows what they're agreeing to.
And that's the key, isn't
yes.
it? So it's a good institution, no matter how old you are.
If you agree to it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.